Hello, do you have ASD or even ADHD and have some addictions that you just don't know how to battle? Well, come along with me down the rabbit hole when I talk with my next guest, David Wyatt, who's a counselor for those of us who have ASD and ADHD all the way out from England. A really nice guy. So sit back, relax, and grab your favorite beverage because you're in for a treat. See you there. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Inside Asperger Studios Presents Stories. Today, I'm joined with David. What is your last name, David? I totally blank out on it.
Wyatt.
David Wyatt, who is an autism. I guess you can consider him an autism coach who's helped people out, but he's really overcome a lot of obstacles in his life. So, David, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. Lovely to be here, Reed.
First of all, why don't you tell everyone a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So I was born in 1981, and I grew up in a town called Nailsea, which is about 8 miles outside of the city of Bristol in the UK. I was diagnosed quite late with Asperger's. I was 37 years old. To cut a long story short, I had real difficulty socializing, social skills when I was younger. I tried to sort of muddle my way through, spent most of my school years kind of getting out of the way. As an adult, I always did very well work-wise. I grew a sales and marketing company, which I ran for about 13 years. But I'd never really addressed a lot of my own personal issues. I'd felt very lost in the universe for most of my life. Mm-hmm. And that really caught up with me when I was in my 30s. And I ended up getting to a point where I had a huge breakdown because I hadn't addressed a lot of the problems that were affecting me. I didn't really understand myself very well either. And I ended up being a drug addict for quite a long time. Tried to kill myself. And at which point then I decided that I was going to, I had one more round in me. And I remember saying something silly at the time, like, I'm going to give it 12 months and see if I can turn my life around. And I asked myself the question, I wonder what the best me might look like. And about that time, because I was really suffering from depression, I was encouraged to go to the doctors and then to various specialists and so on. And it was discovered that I had Asperger's and high-functioning autism. That's where my turnaround really began. I turned my life around. I help my community, and now I coach others, not just with Asperger's and autism, but I help others achieve their dreams.
Very interesting. Now, what did you attribute to overcoming all your addictions?
If I'm honest, it wasn't. It was having purpose in my life. I realized that when I had my breakdown, I was so unhappy with myself that I pushed all responsibility away. I pushed all responsibility away, and eventually my world sort of collapsed in on me, or certainly that was the way I viewed it at the time. And once I took responsibility for myself and I understood myself better and I changed the way in which I saw my world, and I learned a lot and I orientated myself differently, I found that it was much, the things that I saw as impossible to overcome, became easy. I didn't have the time or attention for them anymore. I was no longer escaping. I was a man with a plan, so to speak. And obviously I can go more into detail of how I sort of habits I changed and the way I remapped my mind in order to orientate myself better, which I'm sure we'll get to later. But really, I realized that human beings like to lift a load. You know, we like responsibility, but we have to choose it. You know, we have to choose it. And when I understood myself better, and I found something that I wanted to do more than I wanted to sleep, then it was much easier for me to achieve what I wanted to achieve. I suppose as an example that might resonate, if you want to go to the gym and you say to yourself, you know what, I'm really not very happy with my physical fitness, I'm going to go to the gym. You might do what most people do, which is they go to the gym, they hammer it and go every day for about 2 months, and then they pay for the gym subscription for the rest of the year and barely go, you know?
Yeah.
Because you're going just to try and improve yourself. But say, for example, you wanted to swim the English Channel, or you wanted to achieve a particular sporting feat, and you needed to be fit in order to do that. Well, then you're doing it for a reason. Every day when you get up, you're getting closer to that goal, to what you want to achieve. And I suppose that's a slight example of one of the ways I started turning my life around was to understand what it was I wanted to create. You know, what did I want to be remembered for? What were my goals and ambitions and dreams? And what would it take to get there? And on that list, well, you can't achieve that if you're a drug addict. So you've got to go.
Bravo on you. I mean, not a lot of people can say they've battled their demons and literally turned their life around.
Thanks. It was a tough run. But at the same time, and again, like when you go to the gym, you might go and you've only been three times, and you might not be in the physical condition that you want to be in or that you visualize for the future, but man, you feel good about yourself.
Yes.
You feel your body aching a bit and you feel good. And so it was difficult, but equally, there was also a lot of pleasure to be had on that road.
I know that feeling. I mean, when I was younger, I used to go to a weightlifting class, and you'd feel it after a day or so. You start feeling your muscles start to ache and stuff. And you tell yourself, that's a good ache. It's not a bad ache. You're improving your body, not deproving it.
Yeah. Yeah. You're buzzing, you know.
Yeah. Anyways, how did you overcome your stress and anxiety? I mean, everyone knows that those of us on the spectrum deal with stress and anxiety and then have a hard time working with it. What are your secrets to dealing with your anxiety?
So I think there were a couple of fundamental ways that I saw the world which wasn't helping me. I learned a lot and I studied a great deal after I had my breakdown after the suicide attempt. To give you a bit of backstory on that. When I was at school, for example, I knew I was different. I found it, I wouldn't be having this conversation now. You know, I wasn't nonverbal, but it was very, very stressful trying to make friends. I was very conscious of how I would be perceived. Every time I tried to start a conversation, I felt that it went badly, you know, and I saw it might not have been true, and I'm sure it wasn't, but I saw the world as laughing at me. And I was bullied quite heavily in school. And so because I was, you know, it was socially awkward, I'd made myself an easy target. And to give you an example, when I was at school, we had library passes. There was yellow laminated cards. Mm-hmm. And ironically, I would use the door locks weren't very good. And I'd use my library pass to jimmy the lock on the library door just so I could get in and hide away you know, there was a computer in the corner and I would hide away when the library wasn't open, where no one could see me. And I'd use the computer because I was interested and I knew that if I was in there, well, then I wouldn't get beaten up. And so I spent pretty much all of my school years just trying to get out of the way and avoid any, you know, communication with people. Naturally, that only allowed my anxiety and stress just to build up and build up over time. As I got older and as I really started hammering the books and started learning, I started to change the way I looked at the world. And there were a couple of big kind of fundamental changes that came out of that. One of them was that I started taking responsibility for everything myself. So I realized that it wasn't my circumstances, it wasn't the world around me that was the problem. It was the way I saw it, because I realized that there isn't really, you know, we all have our view of the world. We all have our perceptions. Really, it's, you know, we're all very unique, and our view of the world is very, very different. Everyone's view of the world. I mean, you could almost argue that there's a separate world for each of us, you know. And I realized that when I was feeling anxious and stressed, I used to think I was feeling anxious and stressed because of a situation, because I was worried about money, because I was worried about a relationship, because I was worried about something or stressed about something that happened at work, because I was afraid of climbing a ladder, whatever it would be, any of the stresses through life. I realized that it wasn't actually those things that were making me feel anxious. It was my thinking about it. It was so, and I realized that my feelings were just a shadow of my thoughts. And I'd built up a habit of entertaining negative thoughts, you know. An example I suppose I like to use is, at school I felt very much like a Clark Kent. In fact, most of my life I felt very much like a Clark Kent. And when you look at Clark Kent from a distance, you realize that every time someone tells him what to do, he just does it. Every time someone shouts at him or there's any kind of conflict, he feels useless and cowers by the photocopier, you know. And then you look at say Superman, and he doesn't do that, you know. But and I realized that them being the same guy, I realized that, well, actually, one of the things I do get to choose in my life is how I respond to things. You know, I get to choose how I respond to any circumstance. And when you look at the way Clark Kent responds and you look at the way Superman responds, well, Clark Kent's going to feel that the world is oppressive and beating him down, because every time something happens, he tells himself that he's being beaten down. And so to him, the world is just an oppressive environment. But it's not to Superman, because he doesn't think about it the same way. And I realized that I get to choose how I respond, both in my own thinking and to other people. And I realized that, well, I've sort of created habits, and I used to think, oh, it's just my personality, it's just my traits. But I realized it's more likely that it's just habits that I've created, where I will always respond to things in the same way. And so that was a big, big thing for me, to realize that I could actually control the way I respond, and that my problems weren't coming from the world around me. It wasn't my circumstances. It was my thinking. So those were two big shifts that made a big difference in my world.
Yeah, I think you are. I think you're onto something, because a lot of people don't realize it's not the situation they're stressing about or getting anxiety from. It's the thought of thinking about it. And if you can eliminate that thought and just do the activity or whatever you're planning to do, there would be no stress. There would be no anxiety. It's just like tearing the Band-Aid off. Yeah. It's the thought of thinking about tearing that Band-Aid off. That's what gives you the anxiety. But if you just go and just do it, you're not thinking about it.
Yeah. Yeah, I would always imagine the worst case scenario, and then you go into defense mode. And because I felt like I didn't know how to deal with the situation, my answer was to feel that it was too anxious, that I couldn't deal with it, and just hide away. And because of that, I think that was a big mistake when I was younger, because what I actually needed to do was not be afraid of failure and focus on my social skills, focus on understanding and integrating with others. I realized that, again, at school, and I think you might argue this is a bit of an autistic trait, but I was very focused on me in conversations. So I would speak, and it was about what I wanted to say, not what I could gain from listening to somebody else and how I could really connect with them. And then I realized as time went on that that real connection comes from when people spend time with each other without their thinking getting in the way, when you can just be.
Well, that's funny you mentioned that. I mean, that's my biggest problem with being autistic is I have a tendency to bring things back to myself, and it aggravates my mother to no end. And she keeps telling me, you got to stop thinking about yourself and bringing things back to you. It's not about you.
Yeah, it's a hard habit to break. I would, there's a book that really helped me, which I'd like to, if you don't mind, recommend. It was written by a chap called Mark Galston, and it's called Just Listen. And it's a fantastic book, really, really fantastic.
All right. What was your, now you said you had lost weight. I'm guessing either you joined the gym or you just got more physically active.
The weight loss, so I did it in two stages. I actually didn't start going to the gym, first of all. The problem with my weight gain was 90% diet. So I read a book on my metabolism, and what I started doing, I didn't go on any sort of crazy diet or fad diet. I realized I was consuming an awful lot of poor food that I wasn't, I was drinking a lot of alcohol. I really wasn't looking after myself. My sleep patterns were terrible in terms of the times I was getting up and going to bed. So what I did was I first of all set myself a better routine. So I'd get up at 5 o'clock every morning. And as soon as I got up, I would eat something. It would be very small, like a date or a piece of fruit. Didn't matter, you know, just something small. I decided that rather than having three meals a day, I would eat every hour, and not a lot. I'd eat a small amount, relatively small amount, and I would, of everything, you know, if I wanted a bit of cake, I'd have a bit of a cake. If I wanted a bit of chocolate, I wouldn't deny myself things. Although in the main, my diet was fruit and vegetables and grilled chicken and salad, but I would eat every hour, and I'd have a slightly larger meal in the evening. But the idea was that I kept my metabolism constantly running and just in a deficit. So I'd be up at five, my metabolism would start early, and I'd get a good night's sleep at night. And I found that by grazing and eating every hour, but not denying myself anything, you know, I would avoid junk food, you know, avoid junk food. But I wouldn't sort of say, oh, I'm not eating any carbs, or I'm not eating any, I wouldn't cut out any food groups. And after doing that for about a week and a half, it was like a switch being flicked. The weight just flew off me, absolutely flew off. But I didn't feel hungry either, because I was eating every hour. So I just not huge quantities. So I didn't actually feel hungry at any point. And once I'd lost a considerable amount of the weight, I then decided to really start exercising more and going to the gym. I think when I started losing weight, I found exercise really difficult. You know, it was really tough. So I lost a bit of weight first, and I was doing a lot of learning. I was focusing on other things. And then I went down from about 16 stone to about 10 and a half stone. And that was really quickly. I mean, this is in a period of about 8 months. And it just flew off. And then I started exercising. And by that point, I had a really good sleep routine. I had a good habit with food. And when I started going to the gym, I just doubled everything. I doubled the quantities. So I was no longer just in a deficit. I was over. And that was really how I did it. It was quite simple, if I'm honest. It was a lot easier than I thought it was going to be. Because I always thought that weight loss meant sort of starving myself. And although I was in a deficit, I didn't at any point really feel hungry because I was regularly eating something.
Now, would you recommend to everybody that they, before they even start dieting or trying to figure out how to lose weight, to figure out what kind of metabolism they have and read about it so they know what they're doing?
The only reason I read a book about it was I didn't sort of heavily calorie count. I really didn't take much of a scientific approach other than saying to myself, right, well, I'm going to make sure I'm in a slight deficit, you know, because because I want to lose weight. The book just really pointed out to me that if I get up in the morning and I don't eat for another 4 hours, that my body is going to be in fat store mode. And I figured that, well, if I just kept my metabolism running all the hours I was awake efficiently, then it wouldn't have an opportunity to store fat.
That kind of reminds me of the class I took on weight loss. they talk about that. That your body works on two different modes depending on what's going on. If you haven't eaten anything, it works off of your fat. But if you have eaten something, it works off of what you stored.
Yeah.
So have you figured out what your set weight goal is? What your body's goal is? What it?
Yeah, I set myself a 14 stone. Goal. I wanted to go up to 14 stone. I actually stopped at about 13 and a half stone. And I'm now, I'm only about a quarter of a stone off that goal. But now it's just gym and building a bit more muscle. So I'm not far off it. I've been quite comfortable with my weight for quite a while now. I exercise a lot, and now I go out and I paddleboard quite a lot in the sea. I go to the gym quite regularly. I've been really comfortable with it for a while. It's not really something I think about as much now, but I love having the energy made such a difference. And I now have so much more energy, and I can play with my son and he gets tired out before I do. So that's good.
Now, I have to say, I love your quote that you wrote on your matchmaker.fm, learn to love failure and see it as part of your growth. I mean, that is so true to words, because failure is nothing but a part of your growth in your life.
I used to see failure as a negative. I almost strive for failure now, because I realized that when people say, oh, well, you know, see failure as part of growth, I initially used to interpret that as, well, you know, you're not always going to get it right. And sometimes it's going to go wrong, and just, you know, brush yourself down and carry on. And that was the way I used to see it. But I don't see it that way anymore. I see it on another level again, where actually I want to fail, because I've never learned anything from getting things right. Because most of the time, if I get something right, it's just luck. You know, it's worked out that way. But when I get something wrong, or it doesn't work quite the way I've expected, and I must admit my view on expectations are different now as well, but for sake of this, you know, when it doesn't work out the way I'd expected or hoped, then I learned something every single time. You know, I struggled, as I mentioned earlier, I struggled socially, I struggled making friends, I would struggle with, you know, romantic partners, things like that. And but I realized that actually confidently showing up as me and not being afraid to fail, each time I had a conversation, each time I interacted with somebody, each time I attempted to do something that I felt I was too anxious to do, now that anxiety I feel as excitement, as my anxiety to me now is my body's way of telling me that I'm living life, that I'm about to discover something within myself, and I'm about to learn something. And I love getting things wrong. You know, I have this saying now where I say I collect the no's, a bit like in sales. You know how many wins you've made based on the number of no's you've got, you know, and I do actively, I like failures. I love them because I learn so much more. And if I'm very much open to fail, then long term, I'm going to develop myself far, far more than someone that gets it lucky often.
And that's so true. I mean, if you think about it, failure is nothing, just a part of life. People, instead of putting your hopes high, people should aim for the failure. In this way, they're prepared. If something goes wrong, they don't get themselves crushed or hurt. And if it goes right, they can be happy.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have expectations of an outcome in the same way I used to. I mean, obviously, I plan things and there are things I work towards. But I think very often in life, we can expect something to go a certain way. And if it goes that way, well, that's good. It went that way. We were expecting it. But if it doesn't go that way, we can be crushed, shattered. We can be put off doing it again. I think a lot of that is how we approach it. I mean, this may sound silly, but here's one way I got over my fear of failure. I went into one of the largest supermarket chains in the UK. So I guess the equivalent in the US would be something like Walmart, right?
And you went to Sainsbury.
There we are. That's exactly which one I went. You could have chosen one out of the four big ones and you got it.
Well, yeah, the only two I'm familiar with are Sainsbury and Asda.
There we are. So Sainsbury's, it's exactly the one. It's brilliant. I went to Sainsbury's and I haggled with the checkout assistant over the price of an item. Now,
that I didn't realize you could do.
You can't. You can't do it. They have a very strict policy. You know, they're not going to give you a discount. And I knew that before I went in. But I decided to do it anyway. And the reason I did it is so I would feel comfortable failing.
Oh.
And I knew that, as I say, it was very, very unlikely I would get a discount. But I knew that people might be looking at me in the store and think, what are you doing? But it was so I could feel comfortable failing. And I look at life that way now. You know, I'm happy to fail because I don't have expectations one way or the other. As you know, and I realized that by not having expectations, I get to learn, which is something that I closed myself off from doing before.
Very good. Now, I know you had said this earlier. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Nailsea, which was a pretty small town, which is about 8 miles outside of the city of Bristol.
All right. Yeah. What motivates you, inspires you, and drives you?
I think now, as a coach, what motivates me is changing the way, helping people change the way they show up and see their world. You know, I help people that overcome problems with self-confidence. I help them overcome relationship problems. I ran a marketing company for 13 years and I help entrepreneurs and small business owners be better leaders and grow their business.
All right. What's the best compliment you've ever gotten?
The best compliment? Oh, that's a good question. I think if I'm honest, when I really turned my life around and worked helping my community, I would have, I realized that here in the UK, we like an underdog. And there was a time where I was a drug addict where you would cross over the other side of the road if I was walking towards you, you know? Excuse me, if you hear lots of meowing, I apologize. That's my, one of my cats in the background. I had a lot of people at that point come up and say, you know, wow, you've really turned your life around. And that reinforced, that made me feel of value in society again, and that propelled me forward. My community watched me fall, but equally they watched me rise up again. I think we like an underdog, and I did feel like the underdog that came good.
Right. What's your biggest failure, and what did you learn from that experience?
My biggest failure. I mean, I've had quite a few. I think my biggest failures, divorce, that was quite a big failure. Losing my business was a massive failure. When I started going downhill, I destroyed my own business essentially. And that was a huge failure because, there was a lot of things I'd struggled with in my life, and my business was, because I was good work-wise, I was good professionally, my business was something I was proud of. And I thought, well, despite all of my faults and failures, at least I can do that, you know? But when I destroyed that, I think that was probably the straw that broke the camel's back, you know, that sent me downhill. What I learned from that is that if I keep doing what I've done, I'll only get what I've got. If I don't address the issues that I have, if I keep looking for escapism all the time and I don't work to develop myself, it's never going to get better. It's always going to get worse. But I realized that by actually addressing those issues, we really can live our dreams. We really can. And I realized again that actually, no matter what's happened in the past, anything's possible, and we can create almost anything we want.
Very good. Tell me about three influential people in your life and how they impacted you.
Three influential people in my life. My partner, Beth, she's been really instrumental. She worked for helping, she tutors children in a special educational needs school, and it was about a year after we met and she was convinced, obviously I was a real estate at the time, but she was convinced that I had Asperger's, and it was her that really pushed me to go to the doctors. And she's supported me hugely. So she's definitely one. Another would be when I was really trying to put my life together, I listened to a lot of works by Jordan Peterson, Canadian professor, and he watching his videos, reading his books, made a huge difference in my life. I really did. I remember emailing him and just saying how grateful I was for the difference he made. Yeah.
All right. What makes you feel inspired or like your best self?
Doing what I love. I used to kind of chase money, you know. I was very kind of, well, I need to make money, and everything I did was about, okay, well, I could do this work, I can do that work, and I was constantly trying to make money. And I stopped looking at money as something to be obtained, and rather looked at what I love to do as being what I should attain. You know, what do I want to give to the world? How can I serve the world? That was what I chose to obtain. And money is a tool, you know, and that made a big difference in my life. Now I realize that I'm not trying to earn money. I'm trying to do what I love and serve the world powerfully, as I can. and you know, obviously financially rewarded for doing so. Yeah, that made a big difference.
All right, finish this sentence. I'm at my best when.
I'm at my best when I show up fully in the world.
All right.
When I'm now, me.
All right. If you can turn back time and talk to your 18-year-old self, what would you tell him or her about where you are now in life?
What advice would I give, do you mean?
Yeah.
Don't be afraid of failure. Like we discussed, you know, you're unique. There's no other you in the world. And keep learning, keep broadening your horizons. When we're at school, it gives us a certain amount of structure and education. But when we come out of that, we have a tendency to be creatures of habit and not continually look to expand our world. And, you know, our world is far. There's what's the saying I like? Is the world is what you think it is, but there's a world beyond your thinking. And keep expanding your world.
All right. If you could have a billboard with anything on it, what would it be and why?
It would say, when you change the way that you see your world changes.
And, very good.
That'd be a billboard.
What do you think the world will look like in 5 years from now?
This is interesting as well. It's an interesting question. I think that our world is what we think it is, as I mentioned earlier, but there's a world beyond our thinking. So the world in 5 years will be a reflection of my thoughts, you know, for each of us. I think that we can very much create our own worlds. And so it will be what I create in the next 5 years.
All right. What was your favorite subject in school?
Science, physics. I loved physics. I absolutely loved physics. I came out of school with no qualifications whatsoever, but I loved physics.
Okay. Would you consider yourself an introvert or an extrovert?
I'm definitely an introvert. Although I could stand up on stage and speak to people, and that's fine, but I find it very difficult making small talk. I struggle now even to sit in an audience, for example, and chat to the person next to me and make small talk. But I could, I can quite happily stand on stage and talk. And most of the time I do prefer my own company. I'm quite happy in my own company.
All right. If you could be remembered for one thing, what would it be and why?
If I could be remembered for one thing, it would be helping to inspire others, and realize that they really can do anything. They really can do anything. And I would like to be remembered, for being honest, kind, and sincere.
All right. Now, what got you into becoming a coach? I mean, we know you've battled your demons, but becoming a coach, that's a huge taking in the fact.
Well, I make no bones about this. I became a coach. I mean, I've always been an empath, and I've always wanted to help others. But the reason I became a coach was I figured, well, maybe if I become a coach, I might be able to fix myself. You know, if I'm honest. And that was it. And I became a coach because I wanted to fix myself. I'm still very much a work in progress. But I found something I loved. There's two things in this world that I love. I love solving problems. Just mm-hmm. the way my brain's wired. I love solving problems, and deep problems. I love helping people, and coaching provides me those two things. And I learn every single day, and I constantly build on my own knowledge and understanding. I've helped a lot of people now. So, yeah.
All right. Now we get to the questions, the fun ones, that is, that everyone wants to hear. Okay. What is your favorite word?
My favorite word in the English language is a curse word, I think, my favorite word.
You can say it.
It's probably bollocks. That's my favorite word.
What is your least favorite word?
My least favorite word, can't.
What turns you on creatively, spiritually, and emotionally?
Oh, that's a good question. I think really it's learning. I love psychology. I love learning. I think when I'm studying, when I'm learning, it might sound a bit boring, but that really for me, I love it. You know, it really when I start thinking, just thinking essentially.
All right. What turns you off?
That's a really good question. That's a really, really good question. What turns me off? I really don't know. That's a great question. That's a really, really good question.
All right.
I'm struggling with that one.
All right, we'll go back to that. What's your favorite noise or sound? Or what sound or noise do you love?
Sound or noise? I love music. I absolutely love music. And I think my favorite sound, although there's a variety of sounds, is hearing acoustic guitar. I love acoustic guitar. So I play myself and I really enjoy it.
All right. What sound or noise do you hate?
High-pitched noises. I've got very good hearing, quite acute hearing. High-pitched noises go... instant headaches. So they tend to be on quite a high range, which is frustrating because most other people around you don't really hear them. High-pitched noises really go straight right through me.
I think I kind of got the same thing. I have exceptional hearing, and I've been told by two hearing doctors that someone my age, my hearing is like superb. And then I have tinnitus, so.
I think it's linked to autism in the way in which we process sound. I think there are many people with autism that hear a higher hearing range and struggle with certain sounds.
All right. What's your favorite color?
Blue.
What's your least favorite color?
Probably brown. I'm not a big fan of brown.
All right. What profession would you like to do?
Oh.
Other than your own.
Yeah. If I could do anything, you know, I'd quite like to fly a plane. I wouldn't mind being a pilot. That would be interesting. And being up in the sky. Yeah, I think.
What profession would you not like to do?
I would not like to be a sewerage worker. I wouldn't enjoy that.
All right. If heaven exists, what would you like to hear God say when you arrive at the pearly gates?
Would you like another go?
And when you arrive at heaven, who would you like to meet?
Who would I like to meet? Oh, wow. I think if I'm honest, it would be, it's not a famous person. It would be, an aunt of mine. I had a wonderful aunt called Carol, and she died before a time of cancer. And I think I was quite young, so I never really got a chance to get to know her. So definitely be an auntie. Yeah.
Now, if you can interview anyone in your life, living or dead, but not a celebrity, who would it be?
Anyone in my life, living or dead, that's not a celebrity, who would it be? Oh, that's a tricky one. You immediately think of celebrities you'd like to interview, but when that's off the cards, interview anyone in my life that's not a celebrity. I'm stumped. I'm not doing very well at these questions, am I? That's the second one I've come across that I'm stumped. Probably be my grandfather. Yeah, right. Probably be my grandfather.
And finally, what books do you recommend my audience read?
Oh, wow. I think some of the, the books I've really, either I've really enjoyed or have, I've just seen as great books that have offered a lot of insight. One would be, I mentioned earlier, Jordan Peterson, 12 Rules for Life, was his first book. I recommend that. There's another book I love, although it's a very, very hard read, and it's quite an emotional read, which is The Gulag Archipelago by Alexander Solzhenitsyn. I mentioned earlier Just Listen by Mark Goulston. And I forget the author, but there's a book called The Inside Out Revolution, which is all about how, you know, our mindset and how we view the world. So I forget the author of that. And anything by Michael Neal. He wrote some fantastic books.
And finally, where can people find you on the web?
So my website's davidwyatt.uk. Or if you're on Clubhouse, I'm there quite regularly. So come and say hello.
And that's it, folks. David Wyatt, life coach for those on the spectrum in the UK, one hell of a great guy. And stay tuned next week where I talk with Dr. Ned Halliwell, ADHD expert. That's it. Thank you for being on the show, David.
Thank you for having me, Reed. Pleasure.
No problem.
So don't go wasting. Stop a second, 'cause I know you can taste it. Tell me what you wanna do.